Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. It is Wednesday, the 27th of May, 13 minutes past 9 o'clock, and really great to have you all with us this morning. Another beautiful day, and we get to spend it together talking about what's going on in the world. Can't think of a better thing to do over the next 100 minutes or so, so let's get to it. I will first, of course, remind you that you can be a part of our conversation. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We just ask that your letters be short and to the point and on topic. Otherwise, we love to hear from you. Also, make sure you use this email address, panel at WAMC.org. Let me introduce the band here. Alan Chartok is with us. Good morning, sir. How are you? Dear friend.
I'm very good. Equally dear friend, I have to say thank you for everything you're doing. I mean, you've really made this into a terrific show, which everybody is listening to. People tell me that wherever I am, they say, I listen to the panel every day. It's fantastic, and we owe so much of it to you. I mean, just the Getz, the Linda Ellerbees, for example, that you've been able to do, Joe, have been magnificent.
Well, thank you.
And, you know, it's really quite something.
Well, thanks for thinking it all up.
Well, I did do that.
Both the show and the panel.
Thank you for that. It's one thing to think it up. It's another thing to make it work.
It gave my life meaning, I think.
And you have certainly done that. Anyway, it's been a terrific thing. And yesterday was a good day because I watched Joe Biden, and we'll talk about that later because it was really quite something.
Well, we certainly will talk about that. We have also with us this morning, I want to make sure I press the appropriate button so that everybody is included in our conversation, but Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, Alan. Good morning, everybody. And I heard my introduction. You outed me as Rosemary, so I'll take that.
I did do that, and I giggled, actually, during the...
And talking about brilliant Getz, Joe, the idea that we would have the expert on Homeland Security during all of this is extraordinary. We are so lucky to have him.
Really is, and we... We love that you're here, Bob. Thank you very much.
You're both very kind. I appreciate those comments.
Hey, Rosemary Armeo is here, too. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you? Investigative journalist, UAlbany adjunct professor. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, we're good.
I thought I heard a little reservation there.
No. Are you?
No reservation.
You're home?
I'm eager to do the show and then go out in my garden.
Oh, there you go.
Spending my day and post and weeding. And I name each of the weeds as before I rip them out by their roots.
Do you name them like members of the cabinet or anything like that? Or
members of this panel?
Like this one's a Trump, this one's a Stephen Miller, you know.
That's right, Chris. Yeah, members of the panel, that kind of thing. Chris Churchill is with us, Times Union columnist. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
We're doing all right. Very nice to have you all here. This is a great group, and we certainly welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I'm always excited to talk to this group, but I really like this story because I find it fascinating. I don't quite know what to make of it, so I'm interested in what the panel has to say. But Twitter refutes inaccuracies in Trump's tweets about mail-in voting. Twitter added a link to two of President Trump's tweets in which he made false claims about mail-in ballots, urging people to get the facts. This is the first time that Twitter has done this, of adding information to refute the inaccuracies of the president's tweets. So we were talking about this in the newsroom earlier today with Ian Pickus, and just the question that Ian had, which is a very good one, of, okay, but what have you been doing for the last 3.5 years, number one, and maybe even before that when you started with the birtherism, and even if this is your policy as of yesterday, then you still let a couple go through where he's accusing a former member of Congress, now a member of the media, of murder. I don't know.
That being Joe Scarborough.
Joe Scarborough, right, of MSNBC, former Florida congressman who had an employee in his office, 28 years old. She fainted. She hit her head and tragically died. And now, even though the family, even though the young woman's widow says, look, please stop doing this. We're going through enough pain. We don't need this on top of it. And yet the president continues. Rosemary, what do you think?
Okay, first of all, it is not a First Amendment issue. I keep hearing it framed that way. Twitter is private. It's not the government censoring. Second, they are not journalists. I don't like them editing. I don't think they should be commenting or adding to or judging certain posts as accurate or misleading or not. Either you run them or you don't. And in this case, in the Scarborough case, they have a really clear policy on decency and inaccuracy, and Trump is over the line. He should be, those comments should be expunged. And that's all they can do, is take them off or run them. They should not be commenting on them. Not qualified.
Alan?
Well, you know, this president is such a jerk that it is very hard to see this as not being threatening when he says, because he did, you know, I won't let this happen. I won't permit this to happen. And I think they're getting the message over there. But Rosemary is absolutely right. I mean, and so are you, Joe, when you mentioned, and Ian, when you mentioned this idea that you'll take an occasional one and you'll put a little piece of blue underneath it all and say, you got to go look at this again. And, you know, I study this for yourself. I think this is just awful, awful, awful.
Chris Churchill.
Yeah, I mean, I think they did this with the tweets about the balloting because they're under so much pressure on the Joe Scarborough tweets, which they've kind of just, you know, taking a pass on. They're not doing anything, but like, Rosemary's right, those tweets should be deleted. Those are a scurrilous attack. They're terrible. They're smearing the name of a young woman who died 21 years ago. I mean, the whole thing is just awful. And instead of doing something about that, Twitter's decided, well, they're gonna take on this other issue. But I'm kind of with Rosemary. Like, there's so much misinformation on Twitter. So much, you know, I mean, it's conspiracy theory fest on there. And if right. Twitter is going to do this for the president, are they going to do it for everybody else? Because, you know, that's a pretty big task to take on.
Bob, does this kind of action help or hurt the president?
You know, I think it helps him with his base. But then again, I'm not sure what doesn't help him with his base. You know, I think he could run naked through the streets of Washington and his base would still say that that's a good thing.
I'm with Rosemary.
Yeah, we can all bleach our brains afterwards. There's sort of three points that I'd like to toss
called
into
for that
the conversation.
Too, but yes.
The first is this sense of perpetual victimhood that Trump and his base seems to have. And I feel really bad for him, that their life is so miserable that everybody and everything is out to get them. It's a very weird dynamic. The second is, I'm finding it fascinating that Trump is talking about regulation of industry after he wiped out all of the regulations, particularly the regulations with the EPA and clean water and clean air. But it's okay to regulate or potentially regulate social media. And the comment was made earlier about this is a private platform. You know something? If he doesn't like it, don't use it. Or, you know, he's got enough money. You know, set up your own equivalent. I mean, the worst you do is drive it into the ground like you did the steak company and the airlines and the university and the casino. But, you know, that's a business choice on his part. But this concept that he's going to regulate and that he's that this is protected speech is just beyond me.
Well, but one other thing that you could say there, Bob, and this sort of he's their greatest client. He put them on the map in a way that they never were. I mean, they were there, all right. There's no question. But you know, he really made everybody start looking at Twitter, because how could you not?
He absolutely does. He did, Alan, but that doesn't give him special rights.
Oh, no, and I'm not arguing.
Yeah,
and believe me.
Yeah, no, this is the issue with this cat is that it's there's always an angle. There's always, you know, there's sort of this grifter motivation coming out of him in this White House. And I think this is just another example of it.
But what do you do? And Chris, you alluded to this a moment ago, but Twitter, social media in general is just such a cesspool of negativity that I mean, how do you police all of that? Obviously, this is a higher platform because we're talking about the president of the United States. But, you know, if it's possible, when the president tweets something like that, it devolves further.
Yeah, I mean, Twitter, to its credit, does do a pretty good job of policing certain things. I mean, there's no child pornography on there. They do take people down when they're threatening other people or attacking people, which is why they had every right to take down the stuff about Joe Scarborough. I mean, it was potentially libelous, you know, to accuse a critic of yours. First of all, I can't believe I'm saying this about the president of the United States, but for the president to be accusing a critic of murder, essentially, is just so outrageous. They were well within their rights to take those tweets down. But where it gets tricky is where you get into the areas where, well, maybe it's, I mean, on the mail-in ballots, that could be, you could define that as the president's opinion on mail-in ballots. And he does have the right to express his opinion, even if everybody objects to it, or a lot of people object to it, or think it's the wrong opinion. And I think that's where Twitter gets into some very tricky ground.
That's a good point.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, Joe, if I could jump in, though, Chris, you know, he's the president, and you almost give up your right to your personal opinion for the term of your presidency, because statements that you make are policy. It's not just an opinion. And when you have the apparatus of government following his tweets as if it's a directive, it goes well beyond, you know, sort of just his musings. It goes way beyond that. So I'd push back and say that because he's the president, he is in a different category, and honestly should be held to a different and higher standard, obviously, than we're holding him.
Yeah, but
that's very
Trump
nice.
Trump isn't even into the lowest standards that we have. The only reason he's president is because he wants to make his ideas, his opinions, policy. So everything you just said is in what Alan calls the woulda, shoulda thing. It would be great if that were true, but that is not the president that America elected.
I don't know who used the word grifter. Who just used grifter?
I believe I
did.
Yes, after he called the president a cat.
Yes. So I looked it up. I looked it up on my handheld device, and here's what the definition is. A person who swindles you by means of deception or fraud. Synonymous, scammer, sharper, chiseler, swindler, gouger, sharpie, and related words.
Yeah, I stand by my statement.
Okay.
So he's, me too.
So he's a crook or a magic marker?
Con man,
that's right. So, you do have to wonder if your Twitter then, like, when do you use this next? And is this going to be regular, or is this going to just be, we did it for today, we'll do it maybe in a couple months? I don't know.
And will they chicken out? That's
right,
the question.
Exactly.
I don't think there's anything that we can do about Trump. If we have not learned in almost 4 years that Trump is going to be Trump no matter what we do, and all the outrage, then we're just lost. But the emphasis here should be on Twitter, not in the way Trump does. Trump says, I'm going to regulate it. But why isn't Twitter just simply holding by its own rules, which are fine? As Chris pointed out, they have done a good job with, for example, pornography. And in fact, they go overboard. They have ended up being embarrassed by some censoring of masterpieces of art because they show breasts, for example, or full frontal nudity. It's not really pornography. But they're strict. When they stick with the rules, they're defensible. They cannot edit. They do not have the expertise or the time of staffing to edit. And that's what they're getting into. They should just take the president off and say, sorry, Mr. President, try again.
Oh, yeah. Well,
that would be the end of it.
I kind of assume that Twitter is sort of like how I handle my gym membership. You know, I go once every 2 or 3 months, and then only when I'm getting pressure do I go back. And I'm kind of assuming that's exactly what they're going to do.
What kind of pressure?
Oh, you're getting too fat.
Well, I think Alan was at like marital pressure.
No, I think he got it. Okay. I think he got it. Right. Yeah.
All right. When you look at this and you say, let's go to this letter from Marge, who says, while we're focused on Donnie's tweets, why aren't we talking about, I'm sorry. Let me try it again. How ironic that Trump pretends to be a defender of free speech even while threatening to shut down free speech. A private company deciding what kind of speech to allow on the website they own, that is free speech. A president forcing you to keep content on your website that you do not want there, that is not free speech. That is an attack on free speech. And it's the kind of government overreach and tyranny our forefathers fought to liberate us from. That from Matthew.
I still wake up in the morning. We have a cup around here who says, I don't like to wake up in the morning and realize that Trump is the president. I don't know how we got this guy. This is incredible stuff.
It really is. It really is. And it's hard to, it's all hard to figure out. We will continue trying to figure it all out when we come back. We're going to take a break. We have a wonderful panel assembled. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue right after this. Just a note that today's music all features jazz drummer Jimmy Cobb, who passed away on Sunday at the age of 91. He was the last surviving member of what's often called Miles Davis's first great sextet. Jimmy Cobb passed away at 91. The playlist is posted online, WAMC.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable, and the playlist is there. All right, we have a couple of letters. Let's go to those, and then we'll move on to another topic. Peter says, Twitter is putting a warning on Trump's tweets is based on the idea that some things are true and some are false, but Trump has changed the dichotomy to for or against Trump. So anything Twitter or anyone else does to label truth and lies will inevitably be perceived as partisan. Mike says, what a significant minority of the population is willing to believe or pretend to believe things that are clearly at variance with the facts just because they wish these things were true. We lack the intellectual and moral basis for a democracy. Sadly, we are right at the brink of this tragedy. Wow, that's dire,
it's a strong
isn't
letter.
It? Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And you know, Joe, if we could just jump on this for a second, this idea of for or against Trump, it's this cult of a personality that you've heard many times on this show. We've talked about it almost incessantly. And sometimes it feels like this issue of personal responsibility is something that I think we do need to come back to, because it's showing huge gaps in our community. I saw the pictures, I'm sure you did and our listeners did, of the pool party this weekend in the Ozarks. And,
right.
And I look at it and I think, you know, how incredibly selfish, and the position may be that, well, I'm not going to get sick, but you could be a carrier and you could take it back to your parents or your grandparents or your neighbors. And it's this idea that we have no responsibility to the common good or to others around us other than our own desire for hedonistic pleasure. It's really a grim sight.
Isn't that where Little Abner lived in the Ozarks?
Anyone? I don't know.
No one remembers.
I bet Chris Churchill does. Chris?
Ticket, please. Check, please.
I know Little Abner was in Dogpatch, but I don't know. Was that in the Ozarks?
Yeah, I think so, but I don't
know. Not that I'm aware of.
Okay. All right. Well, Al Cap, wherever you are. Chris, go ahead. Well,
maybe Chris dropped out.
Maybe Chris backed out of this conversation.
You guys are breaking up a little bit, but can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. You all right?
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I'm good. I lost a little bit to that conversation, but I probably didn't miss too much.
You know, I don't think you really missed much.
No, you didn't.
Unless you're a little Abner expert. David writes.
Can we go back to the?
Sure.
Oh, go ahead.
No. Please.
In response to the first letter about Twitter and its platform and it being a private company, things do get a little bit more complicated because Twitter has this special immunity from Congress that basically allows it to say that it's not really responsible for the content that's up on its site. Right. I mean, if something libelous is printed in the Times Union or set on WAMC, it's the station or the newspaper that's responsible. But the social media platforms have this immunity that allows them to basically say we're not responsible for the content. So if they start becoming responsible for the content, it puts them in a little bit of a tricky situation. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It does, Chris, but what's the answer there? Because, you know, if they're taking a message, and let's just use this analogy of they're amplifying a message of somebody yelling fire in a theater, where is their responsibility?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. But, I mean, the one thing that the president or Congress could hold over their heads if they do start to, you know, add these little fact checks or whatever is taking that immunity away, which would make the platforms almost unworkable. I mean, they cannot police the content to that degree.
Right. Every time organized baseball.
Again, I go back to they have set up their own policies as a private company that they follow.
Right.
Well, and immunity is important. Even if we hate what Trump is saying, and we do frequently, it's a window into the way he is thinking and how he is operating that we would not have otherwise. I want Twitter to continue as it is, but they have policies in place. The problem is they are not enforcing them against Trump. That's the issue.
Yeah. Well, that's why the policies usually target illegal behavior, you know, the abusive behavior, violent behavior, and not just opinion. But you're right, Rosemary, in the sense that if Trump were kicked off Twitter, his approval ratings would probably go up. You know, if he had laid low and never tweeted, he'd have been a much more popular president. I mean, it's when you log on and see his Twitter feed that you realize just how bad things are.
You know Chris,
I mean, it looks like the feed of a madman.
It does. And
which,
you know, Chris,
which it probably is.
I was going to say, I'm glad you.
Look, this guy got elected president with a minority vote, right? We all know that. So
yeah.
he thinks that if he didn't have Twitter, if he didn't insult people the way that he did, that was his way of getting elected. And he thinks that that's going to be his way of getting elected a second time. So you would never convince him that this is not good for him or that he ought to shut up because, you know,
well,
if he should. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't think he's capable. I mean, I think even if he understood that it's not good for him, I don't think he's, I think he loves the attention. I think he loves stirring the pot, stirring the anger, getting everybody riled up. I think he kind of enjoys seeing the media react to his tweets. And I think there's a part of his base that loves that too. But
hey, we all love that. I mean, I get it. I understand it. We have some of that same thing here on the radio station when we talk. We like that.
Yeah.
And Trump has, we don't have to guess at this. He said it the other day when he wore a mask for at least part of his visit through the Ford plant. He came out and he goes, yeah, I put it on, but I didn't want the media to have it. He talks. He loves it. It's his sport. And we're never going to change that. There's nothing Twitter can do that's going to change the president. He'll find some other way to act outrageous if they were to take any action. But that's why I'm saying that our attention should be on the way our social media networks operate. If they want to be a media, then the rules need to change. And they need to hire different people who can actually edit. If they just want to be the conduit for opinions and ideas, that's great, but they have to enforce the rules that they make. They make sense, the rules that are that exist.
So here's a silly little question. The president has threatened to take unspecified actions against these companies without any evidence that they're actually breaking the law. So he tweeted on May 16th, the radical left is in total command and control of Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Google. The administration is working to remedy this illegal situation. Stay tuned and send names and events. So, Rosemary, what could he do? I mean, I don't even know what you could do. I assume probably nothing, but go ahead, Chris.
They could take that special immunity away that I was talking about. I mean, that would be one thing that would be really damaging to the companies.
Well, look at organized baseball, for example. Every time they get wise, people threaten to take that immunity away from them too, and allow them to be, you know, sued under the Antitrust Act. So you're right; it's a powerful thing, and baseball has been very careful about that. And I think, you know, but on the other hand, the House of Representatives is not about to go along with Trump and his punishment policies.
But you'd also have to, again, the president's beef is that these platforms are solely working, have a bias against conservatives, which clearly, given the president's Twitter feed alone, is not the case.
Oh, I don't know.
But that gets,
there's a strong conservative voice on all of this social media, and that's why the Russian hoaxers did so well, for example. You know, Trump has not thought this out as much as we're doing here on this program. He says things to threaten and bully. He does it. He did this. This is the same thing with saying, oh, I'm going to strengthen the libel laws. He doesn't have the right, even on the federal level, to do anything with that. But he says it, and it's chilling because it's the president of the United States. He's a bully with a bully pulpit. It's just, We have given him this, and he's taking advantage of it. He's having a great time, I think.
Is it sociological, Rosemary? I mean, that's the question. In other words, you're saying something about the population of the United States who would buy into a guy like this.
I think they kind of enjoy it. It's incredibly entertaining. I don't like him at all, as you know. But it every day I get up and say, okay, what has he done now? It is enthralling in a way. And I don't mean that in a good sense.
Understood.
Yeah. He is an entertainer. He is a propagandist and an entertainer. And social media, it has worked to his benefit, both in getting elected and in staying a person of great media hype.
Right.
And if I could jump in on that.
Go
ahead, Alan.
No.
Every time he threatens, though, the market responds. So even if he is powerless in real terms of inflicting damage on Twitter without Congress, just the fact that he is able to threaten them it gets them to moderate what they do with him, and they back down. And the other piece that I think we need to go back to and remember, he does this strategically. I'm not sure he's as dumb as a fox, Rosemary. I mean, we're not talking about the 100,000 dead Americans. We're not talking about real critical issues right now because he takes us down these rat holes, and we lose sight of some of the really important issues.
I don't think he does it as a distraction. I've heard that complaint for 4 years now. I think he loves doing it, and he does it for the attention. And it is not a distraction when we're looking at the way he operates and gets what he wants through. That's what it is.
But Rosemary, it doesn't have to be one or the other. He's doing it for both.
We do need to understand and look at that.
Yeah, I think.
And also, 100,000 dead.
Right. Chris?
I mean, I think the counter to your argument, Bob, is that he does it when there's good news, too. I mean, when the economy's roaring and there's a great new jobs report that looks really good for the administration, he'll often step on that news with some outrageous tweet or another. He's thinking about it. I just think he's kind of responding in almost a stream of consciousness way to whatever he sees on television or whatever stimulus is coming at him. And I don't think he's the fox in this.
Speaking of Fox, Chris, he has the ability to bite the hand that feeds him. So that when somebody occasionally on Fox, and I say occasionally, does something that is counter to Trumpism, he'll bite that hand. And nothing has been better for this president than Fox. And it's not only Fox, obviously, where he'll do that. Twitter is another great example. He's biting the hand.
Well, yeah, he gets very mad at Fox. At Fox polling.
I'm sorry.
Everyone, his family, his workers, his media, his followers, total loyalty.
That's a very good point. And every time I see Melania walking with him, holding hands with him, I'm wondering, what is she thinking?
Yeah, we can't.
If I could go back to Chris's comment, and Chris, I agree with you about what he steps on his own good news. But sometimes I wonder, though, if that's just because he hates other people having the limelight.
Good point.
And even though it's good news for the country, good news for his administration, it's not good news about him personally. And again, that goes back to the comment earlier about this cult of a personality that has developed around this guy, which is both incredibly frightening and incredibly frustrating, because, you know, a lot of people who should be much more cynical and questioning of the government are just sheeple now and following along with wherever he wants to lead them.
Well, you know, yesterday I watched Joe Biden, and I watched him call Trump a fool.
Right.
And all of a sudden—
For not wearing a mask.
Well, for saying that others, for his not wearing a mask and the rest of it, but calling him a fool. And I said, maybe, just maybe, this guy could do it. I mean, it made every headline. Now, did Trump, I haven't seen it, but has Trump come back against him now because he called him a fool?
It was in response to Trump posting and mocking a photo of Joe in his mask.
Nevertheless,
not only did he call him a fool, but he took that same photo and has turned it into a pretty effective election campaign with a flag in the background. He looks like a leader, you know, those dark glasses and the black mask. It's kind of cool.
I'm sorry, I'm missing this. Who did what?
No, meaning Biden has used it to his advantage.
And Biden should use it to his advantage. But I thought Biden said, I'm not getting down in the gutter with him. I'm not getting down in the gutter with him, and he's a fool. I said to myself, this could get interesting.
Yeah. I think Biden has to be a little bit careful with that, you know, not to go too far down that road.
Absolutely,
but
and he knows it. I think he knows it.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue with our panel. Alan Chartok, Chris Churchill, Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo. We'll continue right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. We were talking just before the break about Joe Biden and the interview that he did with CNN yesterday. President Trump dismissed a mask-wearing reporter as being politically correct on Tuesday, while the presumptive Democratic candidate Joe Biden called him a fool for mocking their use. The president's refusal to wear a face mask in public, defying recommendations from public health experts, has become a symbol for his supporters resisting stay-at-home orders amid the coronavirus crisis. To wear one then is seen by some as anti-Trump. In early April, Trump announced new guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that Americans wear face coverings in public to slow the spread of the coronavirus, reversing the administration's earlier recommendations that masks were not necessary. The president was clear, however, that he would not be wearing a mask, even though, quote, it may be good advice. As the United States nears its 100,000th death from the coronavirus and states grapple with how to reopen without putting lives at risk, wearing a mask to quell the disease has become the latest casualty of Trump-era partisanship. Bob Griffin, what do you make of this debate and why it is even a debate?
Oh, well, I mean, that's what I struggle with, Joe, is why is this a debate? You listen to what our experts are telling us, and that there's scientific proof that masks make a difference and help. It helps slow the spread of this virus. And then you've got a president who's coming out and frankly, I think, taking advantage of his base's anger at everything, and has politicized something that is just so simple and is such part of our common good. It's also really interesting. I don't know if anyone's noticed, though. I just read an article from CNN, I believe it was, that Mulvaney came out yesterday and said that you should wear masks. So even within the Republican Party, you're starting to hear some voices pushing back against Trump's message. But boy, it's really dumb.
You know, Bob, you talk about Trump's base. A big part of Trump's base has always been older voters. And there's some signs out there in the polling that his support among older voters is really right. Starting to slip. And this could be a reason why. I mean, if people don't wear masks, it's older voters who are the most vulnerable. And I wonder if Trump's cavalier attitude about that is kind of getting to them a little bit. You know, I mean, it's in a way he has his base, but he also tends to find ways to kind of slice away at it and make it smaller and smaller and smaller. You know, it gets more intense but smaller every day.
Yeah, and that's why I used the term cat earlier for him, because I mean he's got more political lives than anyone that I've seen, at least in my time in watching politics, and things that he's done that would have taken down complete administrations in the past. Now we just sort of view as sort of a minor issue.
Sure, I mean, you look back just to, one girlfriend.
Yeah. Rosemary?
Well, I think, again, it's been almost 4 years. We know how Trump acts. And people now have enough information. Journalism is always supposed to be about giving people enough information that they can make their own decisions. And I believe that the media has done its job and told people, as have doctors in the medical community done their job, and told people the benefits and the minuses of using masks and social distancing and taking other extremely reasonable steps. And now it is up to us. This is we can blame Trump all day, every day. We do, in fact, and it's justified. But this is on us now. This is on those people in Missouri who decided that jumping in the pool right next to everybody else, thousands of other people, hundreds of other people, was a good idea. I'm beginning to come around to the idea that it's individual responsibility, as Bob said, and not just a bad leader who's leading us astray.
And yet, Rosemary, you're the one who's argued with me on this one. I say that this president is going to get wiped out in the next election. And that's what
I don't. I mean, I think you may be right that he will lose, but I see nothing that indicates a landslide. Nothing that says we've turned a corner. Everyone now knows the truth. They're going to just turn against him. Nothing that. And I look for it, Alan. I believe me. I want you to be right. I just don't see it. I think that he is.
Well, you know, a landslide.
Began to turn this into a cultural issue. It's now you wear a mask and you're pro. and you're anti-Trump. Not has nothing to do with health. He has divorced health advice from political advice. He has politicized it all, and it's been successful. It works.
Alan,
you know, a landslide is defined in American politics. If you get 5% more than the other guy, you are the other person. You are regarded as having a landslide. And right now, I only offer you this, Rosemary, for whatever it's worth. The election is a long time away. But he's leading by more than 11 points, Biden is. I think people have had it with this guy. They think he's a fool. They think Biden is right. He's a fool.
Yeah, maybe. But if you look historically, it's not unusual. And we've seen elections like this before where people have been up by double digits and have lost the election.
Absolutely.
And that's just a caution.
No, it's a very good caution. And I have to say, when I was watching yesterday and I saw him use the word fool, I said, this guy could win this election. He really could, because, you know, the word on Trump on Biden on the street has not been good. It's been he's lethargic, he's sleepy, he's this, and that, and the president tries to enlarge on that. But when I saw that and I saw the sort of confidence with which he handled himself yesterday, I said he's going to win, and he's going to win big, because this is as far away from being a fool as you can be. This guy is very serious. Now I hope his health is good. That's all I can say.
Joe Biden has an immense capacity to put his foot into his mouth. I'm glad, even with the mask on it, and we saw that already recently when he went on a very friendly interview and managed to annoy a whole lot of black voters. I was happier when he was in his basement.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We've got more letters. I'd like to talk a little bit about Kayleigh McEnany when we get back. I really want to hear what you have to say about her, Rosemary. So we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll take a break. We'll come back.
I'm shocked.
And we will go down that road. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Alan Chartok, we have Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin, and Rosemary Armeo, and your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let's go to this story, which has to do with Kayleigh McEnany. You know who she is. She is the White House press secretary, and is there's a piece in the Washington Post this morning about her briefing that she gave yesterday. And the headline on the article is, Kayleigh McEnany's latest briefing is a case study in gaslighting, whataboutism, and false claims. This from Aaron Blake, who writes, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany held her latest news briefing Tuesday, and as with her previous one, she put the brief in briefing. It ran only 20 minutes. But that was plenty of time for McEnany to engage in some massive false claims, gaslighting, and whataboutism. Early in the briefing, she was asked about President Trump apparently ridiculing his probable 2020 opponent Joe Biden for how he looked in a mask during a Memorial Day ceremony in Delaware on Monday. McEnany's response to this question might have been the most puzzling of all, contrasting Biden's public use of a mask with what he does in his home. after slipping in a dig at Biden for not venturing out in public during the coronavirus outbreak in recent weeks. She added, quote, "It is a bit peculiar, though, that in his basement right next to his wife, he's not wearing a mask, but he's wearing one outdoors when he's socially distant. So I think that there's a discrepancy there." There are many more examples in this article. I will spare you, Rosemary.
Okay, so a warning first. I am going to discuss her physical appearance. So those of you who are offended by a woman talking about another woman's physical appearance, I will offend you. This is the perfect spokesperson for Trump. I have disliked and been following her since 2016, when she was an extremely effective surrogate for Trump on CNN, and I don't know why he didn't pick her before this. She is a combination of a really beautiful woman, a perky little blonde in sleeveless dresses with a beautiful baby that she uses as a prop, as Sarah Palin did. She is a true believer, totally loyal. She is Hope Hicks with PR sense. She is exactly what Trump wanted. Remember, he is a genius on marketing and public relations. And yes, she is filled with lies. She always has been. She'll say anything, even if it's demonstrably and provably false. But the problem is, the Washington Post wrote, how long was that article that you're citing? It's very long. I'm a news junkie, and I had to, like, sit down and read and read. People don't. They see this pretty young woman defending the president heartily, passionately, and she is amazingly effective. I think she's really dangerous. That's my view of Kayleigh. I have worried about her for 4 years now.
Let's go to Chris Churchill.
Well, Rosemary, I almost sounded a little bit complimentary. I was a little surprised at that, but I get what you're saying.
Complimentary?
Well, in a sense,
yeah,
I mean, you're saying
she's
saying she's very good at her job, which is
perfect action.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Chris.
I'm sorry. Well, I mean, the thing that she said about the mask might be one of the stupider things I've heard in quite a long time.
Trump is the one who said that. She just picked it up and said, "Oh yeah, the boss was right."
Yeah. Yeah. Did Trump say that? Trump said the thing about why does he wear it, not wear it inside the house, but he wears it.
He repeated that.
Wears it outside.
I don't know who came up with it first, whether it was whether she came up with it or he did, but they're repeating it. That's their line now. That's, oh no, he said, I wasn't making fun of Biden. Why would I do that? I was simply referring to how it was odd that he doesn't wear it at home. Yeah, ridiculous. Like, is he supposed to wear it when he and Jill are in bed together? It's nuts. It really is.
Yeah, it really is crazy.
And away we go.
It is a very intense mask, though, I will say. It covers a pretty good chunk of his face, and put it together with the shades, and it's quite a look. But
yeah, it is. As I say, he's using it as a campaign thing now. It's pretty cool.
Yeah,
Bob.
But it's also good leadership, though. You know, you have to practice what you preach, and people follow leaders, and people follow what leaders do. And by Biden doing that, he's showing us what leaders should be doing. I'll also note, back to the earlier question about the article, Joe, is that never in my imagination could I ever imagine that Sean Spicer would have been the most competent, most honest press secretary for the president.
Well, don't make too much out of that. Yeah.
Well, he is.
Not.
Though. I mean,
was I, not and, actually. Sarah Huckabee was extremely effective too, but Kayleigh's got the whole package because she is pleasant to look at. She has a pleasing personality. She's all perky, and people respond to her.
Those are all terms that I could never use to describe her.
You're a liar.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, the problem with Sean Spicer is he actually seemed uncomfortable saying things that he knew weren't true, right? Which is just a disqualifying quality in that job. I mean, he might have actually had a bit of a conscience,
and that turned out to be
a negative.
I thought that too, Chris. I read Jonathan Carl's book about the Trump show, and he paints a really negative picture of Sean Spicer in that Spicer was very Trumpian, and he was very worried about his own image, And anybody who portrayed him in a way that he wasn't happy with would just get iced out. And it was a different light. I was with you for a long time that I sort of felt sorry for him having, because he came into that job having a lot of credibility with working with the RNC. But again, this portrait of in Jonathan Carl's book is not a flattering one.
I wanted to go back to what I think Rosemary said about I think it was Rosemary who said about Kaylee being a true believer. You know, one possibility is that she's a true believer. And the other possibility is, and I want to be very, very careful here, that she's somebody who doesn't believe it, but who thinks her way to, you know, fortune or whatever is by just saying what she needs to say. And that makes her into something entirely different.
Makes her into Lindsey Graham.
No, well, yeah, I suppose. It makes her into something quite different.
Oh, no, if you've been watching her since 2016, I don't think she's just saying it because she has to. She is a Trump lover. She talks
no doubt.
And a resilience, and she fights back when you contradict her. No.
She's either a great actor
or a true believer.
Well, who's the other one, Rosemary, that's very similar, that plays that role, that Tommy Lauren?
Right? Oh, yeah. Well, she's actually a news commentator. She doesn't work for Trump yet, does she?
No, officially. No. But did she? But did Kaylee McEnany always work for Trump? I mean, she was
CNN. She was a CNN.
She was a commentator during the 2016 elections. You know, when CNN was hiring every Trump person, every pro-Trump person they could in order to look fair and balanced.
Right.
Remember that?
I do, but I thought before that she was a conservative commentator. But
on this one, I didn't think she was. I thought she worked for another politician.
On this one, Rosemary, we just disagree. We just disagree. I think, you know, she knows which side her bread is buttered on, and she's going to do that. You don't know, and I don't know, whether in her own mind she's thoroughly convinced or whether or not she's just good at the game.
You know, and Rosemary, I got to jump in with on Alan's side. I do think that this is just Machiavellian, because I had seen comments that she made about Trump earlier, and they weren't flattering. I mean, I'm sure you saw the same clips that I did.
Yeah, she was working for another politician.
Well, I think Bob's point is
well
taken.
So it's McEnany, Mulvaney, what's his name, the former chief of staff. So was Lindsay. Lots of people have said negative things about Trump and then turned around, bit them back, and kowtowed to him. That means really nothing.
Well, it means that they're all political prostitutes. That's what it means.
Well, it means that they're not true believers is what it means, too.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Ted Cruz can say whatever he wants. But we know what Ted Cruz really thinks of Donald Trump deep down.
Hey, one at a time. I can't hear Rosemary. It's very important to do that. What were you saying, Rosemary?
I said she's a convert. That's worse than – they're the worst kind of true believers. You know, we talk about people who had one view and then they changed. She's one of them. I even think Sarah Huckabee had some thoughts that differed from Trump at times, but I never have felt that with her. She parrots everything he says and even gives him lines that he parrots back for her. She's his protector.
Well, she's just been on the scene a little while now. We'll see about all of that.
Well, that's true, yeah.
You know, I mean, I find her to be very unconvincing when she runs out there and starts to just blabber.
Well, Rosemary, if you're correct, then...
I will never lie to you. She's definitely unconvincing to us, but he's not doing this for us. He's not doing this for liberals.
But where she needs to be really careful is if she becomes more popular than Trump, then her life expectancy won't be very long.
You really think that's going to happen? I don't see that. I just don't see that.
I think anybody who threatens to take even a little bit of the attention away from him is on his bad list.
List, yeah.
what you're saying, Bob, is the New York Times Magazine needs to write this glowing profile of her to get her on Trump's bad side.
Hey, Chris,
that's true, Machiavellian, Chris, but really funny.
There's a good column there.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember.
We saw that with Fauci, didn't we? Fauci joins Trump's team. He's an expert. It's like, wow, how did Trump actually get one of the best people? And then as soon as Fauci begins to get attention, we see the split. So, yeah, I think she's got to walk that line. But like Hope Hicks, I think she's equipped to do it.
You know, this Machiavelli business is so interesting. I once wrote a sort of negative column about Andrew Cuomo and called him Machiavellian, and they got real mad at me because they said, you know, that was anti-Italian. I said, come on, cut that out. You know, what it was is that by the way, there's a lot of different views on what Machiavelli was really all about. But it is interesting that this is the way that people come back.
I'm looking at her Twitter feed as we're talking, and it's Charles Payne, for example, says, I've known Kaylee since I was a regular on Barney and Company, and she was a weekly guest while still in college. She has always been brilliant, poised, and respectful. She shouldn't be a human pinata. She just smiles at the cheap shots and gotcha nonsense. She's beloved by the audience that Trump is interested in.
All right, let's do some letters. We go to Regis, who says, why may Trump win again? Many of us who have a sense of fairness and decency scratch our confused heads and ask how Trump gets away with the bizarre self-centered behavior every single day. He is leading the charge of a divisive, self-destructive movement from behind. He's not a leader as we define the term. Rather, he is emblematic of what many of our fellow Americans have become. I recommend Ezra Klein's excellent new book, Why We're Polarized, a polemic about the poisons of identity politics. Then,
yeah, I think.
Go ahead, Chris.
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, sometimes we talk about Trump's base as if they love everything that he does, and I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think sometimes they just see him as a bulwark against parts of society that they dislike even more, or that's trends right. that they dislike more.
That's right.
All right, and we go to Karen, who says, anybody see Biden's interview with Colbert, which I believe aired last Friday? I thought he did a really good job with that. Felt like a president. Of course, it was a very friendly interview, but it was good. Jim says, if Trump takes the move against social media, how long until he goes after public radio? Alan?
Well, we know he's already gone after public radio. He's gone after the whole press, but he's gone specifically after public radio and public television. I think that'll happen. We've gone through this with a lot of presidents, and I've talked about this before, starting with Ronald Reagan. Reagan hated NPR, and my understanding was that he called it News from Managua. But he didn't get anywhere because, you know, the NPR stations, and I don't want to get into this right now, but the NPR stations have a bad habit of catering to money, and they put big money at the head of all of their boards, and some of the various stations do. We, of course, do not. When Reagan went after them, they all called him up and said, hey, Ronnie, please, I'm the chair of the board here. So, it didn't quite work out the way he wanted, but he did manage to say that NPR would not be given any money from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Big deal. They give it to us, and then we have to give NPR that and a lot more from our own stations. That's the way it worked out. But every Republican president has said that.
With the subject line, I know how we got this guy, Sharanjit writes, I would like to say that I agree with you 90 to 95% of what you say. The way we got this guy is that his country has statues of racist men and their causes throughout the nation. i.e. Civil War losers. The many genocides that the nation has committed and continues to do so is barely acknowledged in history books and current media. Even when these crimes are acknowledged, the conversation immediately shifts to how much worse the Nazis and Hitler were. We get it. As a person of color, I observe and experience the institutionalized racism, even in the so-called progressive northern states. We got this letter from Jim who says, here's how Trump got in. Backlash over Obama, a black man in the White House. Young man, white rage. Middle class getting pushed further down. Hillary ignores middle America and Republicans who will not vote for a Democrat. Trump tapped into the anger and despair and pulled out the election. Oh, and throw the evangelicals in there as well.
Oh, come on. If Obama had been allowed to run against Trump, he would have beaten his pants off. There's no question about it. Obama was extremely popular, still is extremely popular in this country, as is his wife, who many people think should have been the candidate or at least the vice presidential candidate. Come on.
David writes, the president did not have his right to speak abridged. He said everything he wanted to say. Twitter exercised their right by adding appropriate facts. After all, it is their platform. Keith says
his message certainly got out, didn't it?
I mean, it certainly did. Yes,
we're still talking about it. Actually, if Twitter is going to start to review the president's tweets, I wish that did spell check for him though.
Yeah, but it's so fun. Keith writes about the presidential daily briefing. Oh, I'm interested in what you all have to say about this. Shouldn't the president of the United States be reading and taking the presidential daily briefing around this time of day? Instead, he is tweeting out slander, grievances, and dividing the nation. Maybe if Trump had spent more time with the presidential daily briefing and less time tweeting, the United States would have a better response to the COVID virus in January, other than waiting for 2 months before taking it somewhat seriously. Well, he had a lot of time in February and March, and that didn't go so well for him either, did it?
You know, I never take issue with you, Joe, because you're a brilliant man, nor with Rosemary for the same reason, and not a man, but a woman.
And I'm not a brilliant man.
Yeah, I said woman. I got there before I knew you would. But you have both talked about how, you know, amusing this president can be and the rest of it. You would not have said that about Hitler or Mussolini. This guy results, the kind of incipient racism that we see from him ends up with four cops with their knee in a black man's neck and killing him. You know, this is the people are dying because this president said there was not really a problem with the COVID-19. Come on. You know, this is a very dangerous man. I think we have to remember that.
Well, I respectfully don't disagree with you. What my comment was, and it was in Bob about spell check. I think you don't let that go. I think you let it. I think you let the person's ignorance, perhaps, go unchecked.
And the truth is that I would say that Hitler was not exactly entertaining the way Trump is, but mesmerizing. Yeah. And I've actually watched tapes of him giving speeches, trying to understand how Germans could have bought into him. Similar to the way I wonder how Americans buy into Trump. And there was something about his speaking style and his use of propaganda that caught up people. And that has nothing to do with the evilness of his message, and the same with Trump. But the entertainment value and the personal charisma part of it, the cult of personality, that's there in both men.
Well, the real question is, in the case of Hitler, did they tap into him, or did he tap into them, his population? I think he got that. And I think there was a sort of German national character, I would argue with some people, I'll settle for at the time. I think Trump has made that same decision. He sees a minority of the American population as being susceptible to this terrible message of his. Remember that Hitler was dealing with a minority also at the beginning, but in the end, we see what happened.
Yeah, I agree with that. That was well put, I think.
Yeah, and Alan, I agree with you, and I think this goes back to the earlier letter about sort of this institutionalized racism in the country, and he has tapped into that. If you think about our immigration policy under this current administration, if you think about the wall, I mean, we talked about the wall, I think, you know, last week or the week before, where, you know, the taxpayers are going to be paying almost $30 million per mile.
Voting rights? How about voting rights?
And voting rights. These are all perfect examples of a system that obviously we need to do more work on. And I think a lot of us thought that after Obama was elected, that the country was starting to transcend some of our original sins. And Trump shows us that we're not, and a lot of work needs to be done.
But the encouraging thing, Bob, is that it isn't really working in the sense that he's not building a majority coalition, right? I mean, I think I've said it here before that I think the Mussolini and Hitler comparisons are way over the top, and I'm not really comfortable going there. But we've seen American politicians play on racial grievance for as long as we've known, right? For as long as we've had American politics, and Trump does it too, but it's not working for him the same way that it's working, that it worked for many other politicians, right? And I take your point that we thought that was over after Obama, but that was probably a naive thing to think, you know.
It could, Chris, but when you look at his numbers, though, and you look at that base that doesn't seem to move, whether it's in the 30s or low 40s, you got to ask yourself the question of really, is there that many of us that believe this? And I struggle with that. I really do, because I listen to what he says and I think, you know, this guy's the Jim Jones of politicians. How can you continue to drink the Kool-Aid? But they do.
But people are there for all sorts of different reasons. You know, the people who are in Trump's base are there for a lot of different reasons. And I think it's too easy to just oversimplify and say, well, they're there because of racism or this or that. I mean, some of them are just very much anti-abortion and they see him as the bulwark against that. Other people are against globalism. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons. And you know, I think we have to remember, too, that he won the election because he got a lot of Obama voters, you know, and he got a lot of people who were disaffected with politics.
And disaffected
with Hillary, too, but disaffected with politics and for good reason. I mean, if you live in a, you know, formerly industrial city and you've watched it sink away for a generation and no politician really seemed to care, I can get why people were angry. And I, you know, the big question is always whether Trump is a symptom or a cause. And in a lot of ways, I think he's just a symptom of things that were wrong in our society long before he came along.
Well, you wouldn't say that about racism. I see we really do disagree with this. I think racism was the primary reason that Trump got himself elected. And everything that he's done since points to that also, Chris. So we're not going to agree on that, nor are we going to agree about what you said about Hitler and Mussolini. And I think the techniques, if you look at the techniques of those guys and you look at the techniques of this president, you're seeing the same thing.
The techniques of demagoguery. And this whole conversation feels kind of old to me because we had it back in 2016 when he first ran.
We're still relitigating 2016.
But we
just have
different now.
We got to take a break.
Years we've seen children locked up. Okay.
Just pause, and we'll be right back after this. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo will press President Donald Trump to invest in the nation's roads, bridges, and rails during a White House meeting scheduled for about 25 minutes from now at the White House to begin reopen after the coronavirus outbreak left the economy in tatters. Cuomo's visit to Washington comes as his hard-hit state begins to see drops in rates of hospitalizations and deaths, while other states relax lockdowns and partygoers flout precautions aimed at curtailing the novel coronavirus. I'd love to be a fly on the wall for that conversation. Alan, what do you think will be the result?
Well, remember that the prime reason that Trump believes he could get reelected is with his base, the very base that hates the blue states. So it's up until now, he has done nothing for the blue states. Cuomo has gone to Trump at least three times that I know of and asked for the tunnel into New York, the rail tunnel, and has been flatly rejected, on that. So he's going back again, and he's going to ask again. It helps him to have Trump refuse him, I suspect, but to also be saying that, I tried. Now, I have to say, if you go to Chris Churchill's article this weekend about Cuomo beginning to lose some oomph, it is interesting that this may work for both men. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Chris? Did we lose Chris?
Hello, Chris. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm breaking up again. I didn't hear very much of that. I heard my name briefly mentioned, but
I said you had written a column.
Were you referring to the column?
Yes,
the
I was.
The column that was published yesterday?
Yes, I was. Yeah.
Let's go to Chris. Go ahead. Or maybe not.
Do you want to jump in, Joe? Because I have a couple of thoughts.
Yeah, sure.
I think Trump is going to come out and say that Cuomo begged him for this money, and he said no. And at the same time, I think where the governor is really smart is that he's really not talking to Trump today. He's talking to the next administration. So he's continuing to put New York needs in the limelight for the next administration. And he's speaking to Congress. He's going to get nothing from Trump other than ridicule. But at the same time, he recognizes that this is how you plant the seeds that hopefully will grow.
Is Chris back?
It makes good sense, too, that he's saying this. You put money into infrastructure and you're accomplishing two things. You're building infrastructure, which even Trump has talked about for the past 4 years as highly needed, and you're jump-starting the economy that badly needs it after the virus. So it's again, he's positioning himself nationally, and who knows, maybe Trump will throw a bone of some sort at him. He has nothing to lose by going.
Well, he may. He may be seen, Rosemary, as deserting his base by giving some to a blue state, and he has not done that up until now, and he has been saying no all along. And as for Bob's contention, what we're looking for in the next administration, if Joe Biden is elected, Cuomo is the governor of New York State, he's going to get everything he needs. They are pals from way back. They're on the same team. If the Democrats win, especially if they win the Senate and the House, New York will be flush.
Chris, are you back?
So. I am back. Yeah, Biden. Don't you think? I mean, Alan, don't you think that there's a good chance that Cuomo would go work for a Joe Biden administration?
I do not. I'll tell you why not. There are two jobs. There are two jobs he could take in that administration. One is obvious, and you know it as well as I do. One of them would be attorney general. Mm-hmm. And the other would be something he's not really that prepared for, which is secretary of state. Otherwise, what would you do? I mean, where would you go? What would you do? I think I know him fairly well. I've watched him for years and years. I think he, Cuomo, is a guy who wants to be his own boss. And he is his own boss as governor of New York State. And so that while you may turn out to be right, because because Papa didn't win a fourth term, and I'm assuming that that Andrew will. But you know, I think he stays where he is.
Yeah, you're right. It is very difficult to win a fourth term, but because his father wasn't able to do so, he might want to take on that challenge. I don't know. But,
I agree. Yeah.
I think you might be right too, because if you think about if Biden is going to be a one term president, if I put the if out there, then I think being governor probably puts him in a better position to take a potential run at the White House. Although I'd say that, I would love to see him as the Attorney General, because I think the Department of Justice is an absolute pigsty right now and needs somebody who can go in there and really muck the place out.
I don't know. That's an insult to pigs, I think. I'm quite frequently resorting to the old poem about the pig got up and slowly walked away. Okay, I'm sorry.
Chris, let me just jump back, because I know you were in and out of our conversation, but Alan referenced the column that you wrote yesterday, which the headline is Andrew Cuomo's halo has lost its shine. So give us a sense of what led you to that, and obviously early on being depicted as a hero of the pandemic, but now that record being reassessed.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that hero status, or the kind of adoring attention he got, some of it was deserved. I mean, and it was largely to do with his communication skills, you know, and especially when he was being contrasted against a White House and a president that kind of has lousy communication skills. He seemed very forthright and very calming when people felt, you know, unnerved. But I think the assumption always was that the rest of the country would experience the pandemic the way that New York has, and that Cuomo said over and over again that we are the canary in the coal mine. And that kind of turned out not to be true, that, you know, that it never spread to the rest of the country the way that people assumed that it might. And that raised the question of, well, why did New York take it so hard? You know, and there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, the density of the city, public transportation, you know, all these various factors. But part of the reason is also some of the decisions that Cuomo and de Blasio made that turned out to be, you know, questionable. And we've seen, after so much glowing national media attention, the tide has turned a little bit. There was a really exhaustive reporting done by ProPublica that kind of portrays de Blasio and Cuomo as kind of these bumbling egoists who couldn't get out of each other's way. The New Yorker did a big piece with kind of a similar theme. And I think, you know, his record is being reassessed. And I think there's a Siena poll that came out this morning that said, you know, New Yorkers are still overwhelmingly with him. But we'll see if that sticks.
Bob?
Yeah, I mean, I have so many thoughts popping around from Chris's comments. I do think that the rest of the country benefited from New York sort of being in a leadership role, in the same way I think we benefited in being able to watch what Washington State did. I don't think the COVID situation has run its course yet. And I keep looking at numbers, and I keep looking at numbers in places like Los Angeles, but also in the rural communities. And I still believe that New York was the canary in the coal mine. Whether people pay attention to it or not is a question. The other point, Chris, that I can't quantify for you is the press that was received by New York. What did that do to change people's activities? I think that did play a large role in it. And now we're seeing people sort of revert back to normalcy, what they consider to be normalcy. And we have to watch for spikes.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you that this story has not fully been told. We don't know what's going to happen. The next few months will determine a lot. The next year will determine a lot. But, you know, if you go back and look at the comments that the governor and de Blasio were making well into March, I mean, they were being extremely reassuring, telling people that it was safe to go out and do them. De Blasio especially, this is a little bit more on de Blasio than it is on Cuomo, but, you know, telling people to go to movies and go out to eat. And, you know, there was that kind of devastating Columbia University study that was released last week that found that if they had just begun the lockdown a week earlier, something like 17,000 lives of New Yorkers would have been saved. You know, and it's that kind of thing that people are taking a closer look at now. That I think it's justified. I mean, as I said in that column, to expect perfection out of any politician with a in the face of a crisis with this kind of scope and this kind of complexity is foolish. But it is worth taking an honest look at the decisions they made and some of the mistakes they made. I mean, another mistake that Cuomo made, I think, was the nursing home decision, requiring hospitals to take COVID. I mean, nursing homes to take COVID patients from hospitals. I think that turned out to be a poor decision.
Hero worship, weird too. Why we turned Cuomo into a hero for doing what really Trump should have done and other governors did do. That's interesting. We totally forgot his bullying, his personal problems, his corruption. All of that just receded because we're so grateful to have someone who, whether the decisions turn out to be perfect or not, they certainly made sense at the time and we were not getting them elsewhere. So it's the cult of personality thing that we seem to want to love or hate our politicians these days.
We have 1 minute.
Exactly.
Go ahead.
That's exactly right. I think that is a problem in our politics. We do want to make people into heroes or villains. And we made certain governors into heroes and other governors into villains. And I think that a lot of times these are just people doing their best under very, very difficult circumstances. And sometimes they make mistakes and sometimes they do the right thing. But, you know, most of them are trying to do their best.
Right.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to everybody for being with us this morning. Great conversation. We thank all the letter writers and, of course, thank Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Chris Churchill, and Bob Griffin. We will continue and have the Congressional Corner next on the Roundtable.